Today we'll be looking at a topic that I think some people in the field of psychology and child development have been thinking about now at least for a couple of decades. And it's this. If you take a look at families where there are a great many disadvantages, families don't function well, they may have to struggle with poverty, there may be violence in the family, you will see, and not surprisingly so, that some of the children who grow up in families like that grow up to have serious difficulties of their own. However, you do also see something else. Sometimes you see kids born into these very difficult families who, despite those difficulties, manage to grow into perfectly competent adults. And the question that a lot of people in psychology and child behavior have been thinking about is, why is that? Why is it that some kids who are born into broken families manage to grow into competent adults while others do not? It's an area that generally is referred to as family resilience. And we'll be talking this morning with a researcher who has worked in this area now for some time, Ann Maston. She is a licensed psychologist. She is also a distinguished McKnight University professor in the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. And this is one area that she has concentrated on in her research. She is visiting the campus. She gave the spring 2005 lecture sponsored by the Pamperchef Family Resiliency Program here on the campus. And we in the past have talked with a number of the speakers who have come to talk in this series, and we're pleased that she could be with us. If you didn't hear her talk, well, you've missed it. It was last night, but she's been good enough to hear and be with us here on the program and talk about some of the same subject matter. And, of course, questions are welcome. They always are here on the show. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief and to the point. That way we can get in as many different people as possible and also keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone listening can call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, if you have questions, you are welcome to call. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
To begin, maybe a little bit of general background on resilience and how it is, and I think now it's been for at least a couple of decades, people in your field have been looking at this. How did the whole field of study of family resiliency get going?
Well, I think it began back in the 60s and 70s when scientists started to try to understand the causes of mental illness. And they realized some children seem to be more at risk for developing problems. And they were initially focused just on risk and understanding how problems developed. But what they discovered when they started to study children who maybe were coming out of very difficult situations or had a parent with a mental illness is that a lot of the children managed to grow up and flourish and be successful even though they were coming out of very difficult circumstances. And it surprised the researchers initially. Mm-hmm. And some of the pioneers in this area realized right away that, you know, this is important. We need to understand how children succeed in life and come out of the, you know, difficult situations, not just, you know, what causes problems in children, because we want to try to help children, to help families become more successful. And we could really learn something if we studied successful families and successful children who were overcoming adversity and not just always look for problems.
Yeah. What I think I take away from this, the bottom line here, and I think it's very interesting, is that it seems that initially the supposition of people who were studying these kinds of children was that somehow these kids were exceptional. They were somehow exceptionally heroic, brave, strong, everything that the term resiliency would tend to suggest. But that eventually, with enough study, that we come around to a rather different idea. And I know in different things I have read that you have written, you put it in different ways, but always in a very nice turn of phrase, essentially conveying the idea that these children are not exceptional. They're not superhuman somehow. That what they have going for them in their development are the same factors that operate in other kids. So it's very ordinary. I think that's the word that often you have applied to that. We're really talking about very ordinary things. Now, The circumstances may not be ordinary, but the systems that function to help these kids make it are perfectly ordinary, the same that any other child has.
That's right. And I think this surprised many researchers because I think there's a tendency to expect that some sort of magical right stuff, some special mm-hmm. quality is what enables children to overcome great adversity. Mm-hmm. And what it turns out to be is some pretty fundamental basic protections that have probably protected human development since the beginning. And at the top of that list would be connections with competent, caring adults, most often parents. And parents don't need to be exceptional. They just need to be good, ordinary parents who are doing their job and looking after their children. But, of course, there are a lot of children out there that don't have that kind of adult connection. Sometimes they don't have it in their immediate family. And the kids who make it in those situations somehow have been connected to another adult who serves that role, because that's fundamental. Kids need connections with adults. But that phrase you mentioned, ordinary, I sometimes talk about ordinary magic. And what I mean by that is that we have very powerful systems that help us rear our children and that help us develop well. And if they're working, if they're operating like a good parent, like a healthy brain that's learning, that children can recover and do well under very difficult situations.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds also as if that these children, while they may not be exceptional in terms of their ability, their intelligence, and so forth, you do have to have them be at least kind of average. It sounds like if they come into the world with various kinds of deficits, that is going to be a problem. I mean, that is going to make it more difficult for them.
Right. I mean, some children are more vulnerable, and those children may need some extra help along the way from parents, teachers, and so forth. But I think my point is more that to overcome and recover from great difficulty doesn't require special talents or special kinds of parents, but rather just fundamental, good old-fashioned parenting and thinking and learning and communities mm-hmm. that support children and their families. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the situations that have the most devastating mm-hmm. effect on children and their lives are those situations that actually destroy those systems. So if in a natural disaster or in a war or in the kind of war that's waged in some families where you have violence, if the parents themselves are harmed so that they cannot no longer function as parents, if a child is injured in such a way that they can no longer learn, that has a devastating effect on development. However, if you can protect a child through parenting support, through good nutrition, if you can restore the basics for child development, then children can weather amazing storms and recover and get on with their lives. But if you destroy the family and nobody steps in to take the place of a family for a child, then a child is in real trouble.
Our guest this morning is Ann Mastin. She is a professor in the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, and we're talking about the idea of family resiliency and how it is that that works and how it is that some children can grow up in really tough, disadvantaged circumstances and in families that don't function well, and yet, given the right circumstances, can grow up and to be well-adjusted, competent adults. We have a couple of callers here, and one person particularly here on a cell phone, so I want to get to them so that they don't have to wait too long here. It's our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have two questions, which I'll ask and then hang up and listen. The first one is, I remember a number of years ago, David had a guest on who spoke about Holocaust survivors and the people who managed to go on and lead very fruitful and happy lives after having survived concentration camp. And I'm wondering whether you've made a connection between the childhood of those people and the children you study today. The second question is actually more important, and it's a problem I have with implementing psychological studies into social policy. Are you concerned with the possibility that your studies will lead to basically bad social policy. To give you an example, it turned out that the entire self-esteem movement, which seemed to be based upon the idea that you make a child feel good about themselves, whether or not they've done anything to deserve to feel good about themselves. And they found recently that this leads to a real catastrophe when these children get into an environment of competition with other children, and they find that, in fact, they're not, their self-esteem isn't, is false. And so that concerns me. And what are you doing to make sure that that doesn't happen with your work, as seems to have happened with the self-esteem movement in this country? Thank you. I'll listen on the phone.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, those are two very good questions. I mean, I'll address the second one first and then come back to the Holocaust survivors. That was a very unfortunate and interesting phenomenon where the self-esteem movement, and basically they got the cart before the horse. And you always hope that the research that you and your colleagues do doesn't get taken up in such a way. And by that I mean that it is true that resilient kids often have more self-confidence. They believe they can do things. But that is because they've had the experience of success. And in human beings, we're born with an inclination to be motivated to, try to make an impact on the world. So that's why even a little child in a high chair, when they figure out they can throw things off the high chair, they get such a kick out of tossing all their toys on the floor. When children learn to walk, they get a huge kick out of toddling along. We are made to experience success in mastering the environment, and this is a very important system for development and also for coping with difficult situations. There's been a lot of research showing that if that system is working, when people succeed, and of course, they need opportunities to succeed. But when children have a chance to be effective in the world, they get a kick out of it. They get pleasure out of it, and that motivates them to try again and to persist in the future. And the studies of children who've been neglected in orphanages, you may have heard of those. You know, for example, in Romania, it was discovered after Ceausescu's regime fell that there were a lot of kids in orphanages who'd been profoundly neglected. They just didn't have enough adult caregivers around them. This system was often shut down in those children. If babies are left alone in a crib with no interaction with people, and they never have a chance to get a response from an adult and to see that the world reacts to them, they never get a chance to play with toys and be effective, that system shuts down and you get kids who become very hopeless and apathetic and aren't responsive, and you have to get that system going again. But it's a mistake to think that just creating a sense of self-esteem and confidence that isn't built on any substantive experience of having achieved something is the way to go. And I thought it was pretty clear in these unfortunate social policy experiments that what they ended up with by focusing on only self-esteem was a group of kids that may have still been misbehaving in ways that were totally unacceptable, but feeling great about themselves, which is not a good combination. And I guess I would say that the kind of self-esteem that you see in young people who've overcome great difficulty to succeed is actually that sense of pleasure that comes from real accomplishment, and that, kids having the opportunity to learn to do something, to do it, and to experience success in doing it is the kind of self-confidence that I think we want to build. So I think that and hope that the kind of research that's done to try to understand, how children succeed will help us keep things in the right order. And I think that was one example of what can go wrong. To come to your second question, which was about the Holocaust survivors, there's been, of course, a number of long-term studies. There was a book by Moskowitz about children who survived the Holocaust in particular. And there, you know, I think that it's hard to imagine some of the any worse experiences than some of these children went through, losing everything familiar, living in concentration camps. Similar situation occurred in Cambodia during the time of Pol Pot, when, you know, there was horrible genocide perpetrated on a population, and a lot of children lost their families, were sent to work camps and this sort of thing, and they saw unbelievable things, ranging from their families being killed and tortured to many, many other things that we don't want to think about that happened to children in wartime. And over the years, the Holocaust survivors from Europe, I think, have taught us that there are, first of all, there's a lot of recovery, but also that there are different ways that people recover. Some people need and want to share and talk about their experiences, whether it's during therapy or just sharing with their friends and families. And other survivors express their experience through literature, through art, through telling their stories, through being a witness. I mean, I know that many of you have probably been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and there's a room there for where you hear the voices of survivors who talk about their story and their survival. And that may be a very important healing process for some individuals. But for other individuals, they find it best for their lives to let go of the past and move on. And a lot of the Holocaust survivors have grown up and married and had children and gone on with their lives and done very well. And some of them have not addressed the experiences they had and have kept quieter. So I would say that I've learned from talking to some of these survivors and also from doing research with Cambodian young people who came out of that Holocaust situation that there's a lot of different ways to make it, but the common ingredients that I see across these situations is that very young children who overcame Holocaust war-type situations all had adults who were looking out for them. I see that as fundamental for the survival and of young children. And competent, caring adults, not always their family members. In some of the concentration camps, of course, children were separated or their parents were lost. And other adults kept an eye on them and helped them along the way. And then other adults, as they left the camps and were adopted or taken to Great Britain, England, all over, went to Israel and so forth, that the reestablishment of family, of connections with people, was very, very important. In the Cambodians who have come to Minnesota, where I live, after the war and made a new life there, some of the young people came unaccompanied without any family members. Many of them have had not only the help of caring adults and families, but they've also been helped by the reestablishment of their cultural traditions. And in the case of a Holocaust where a whole culture is being systematically destroyed, which was true in Germany and was also true in Cambodia, I think it's been very important to recover the cultural traditions. And among the Cambodian people, there are very important religious practices, very important dancing and language traditions that they have recovered now and begun to teach their children again. And cultures for centuries have provided people with rituals, with ceremonies, with traditions that can be very helpful in not only dealing with adversity, but also recovering over the long term.
All right. I hope it gets to the question of the caller. We have some others. We will continue to talk with our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Ann Maston. She is a licensed psychologist. She's also a distinguished McKnight University professor in the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, visiting the campus. She gave this year's spring 2000. 2005 lecture in the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program, talking about this concept of family resiliency. Questions certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I just thought I would mention here very quickly, I don't usually do this, but I do want to mention tomorrow morning's 10 o'clock hour, because it connects certainly with some of the things that we're talking about here this morning. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will be talking with Karen Landgren, who is Chief of Child Protection at UNICEF. She is going to be here on the campus to give this year's Daniel Sanders Peace and Social Justice Lecture. That's tonight on the U of I campus, talking on the topic, Children in the Crossfire, Can They Be Protected? And so if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can go and hear that lecture tonight. But of course, if you can't, she will be here on the program tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, and we'll talk with us. So maybe we'll get into some of the same issues, some different sorts of things. But I did definitely want to mention that. We have some other callers here, and we will talk next with someone who is listening up in Aurora on our line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Good morning again. I'm sure I called before, but I just thought I would tell my story for whatever it's worth for anybody else that might be listening. I was brought up in the Great Depression with a mother that worked long hours, and we were left alone all the time, and had nobody to, I mean, we just didn't have anybody taking care of us, period. And the three of us survived. We didn't survive very well. I noticed that other children were taken care of where we weren't. You know, I did notice at a very early age, I must have been about 9 when I noticed other mothers took care of their children. My mother, of course, was an immigrant and didn't have the benefit of, as you were just speaking about the people in Cambodia, connections. And we lived away from her connections, but we did go to where her people lived in New York about once every season. And I noticed my mother was happier with her people. But when as I was growing up, I decided that I would not be like my mother in many respects, that my lifestyle would be different. And I began at a very, very early age to read about being brought up and about children. And especially when my children were coming, I read every book or every article about how to bring up children so that they would be brought up and be happy, and that there were ways. You know, I wondered when I was young, what is the right way? What is the correct way so somebody will be happy in life? I thought about that a lot in life. Of course, the fact that we lived in the Great Depression was very difficult, you know, with no food, etc. But then when I got older and I found out about therapy and that you could go to somebody and tell them their problem and find out the solution, that was my greatest thing I ever did for myself and for my family. I let everybody know I go to therapy. It's no big secret, because I feel if I learn how to do things the right way and provide happiness in a family, that's a very, very good thing. My sister, my older sister, of course, she would not ascribe to that at all, and her family has fallen apart. It's very sad what her family is. She makes a lot of the mistakes that my mother made. And see, I vowed if I could, I wouldn't make the mistakes my mother made. I just thought for anybody out there that wants to get a handle on how to improve their life, I'm not telling them to go, but I'm saying that I went and it benefited my life. And my children's especially.
I want to thank you for calling and sharing your story. I think you must have been a very special young person who was, because I'm picturing you as you spoke, you were searching and you didn't give up hope and you looked in books to learn. I'm wondering if you're still on.
Mm-hmm.
If you had any connections with teachers along the way who encouraged you at school?
I had a few teachers, Miss Higgins in junior high, that was very kind.
Okay, because I feel as if something, you know, you had a very positive experience somehow with learning, and I think as a searcher and a thinker that you had one of the other special qualities we often see in resilient young people, which is that they're good at figuring things out. They're good thinkers, and I have talked with a number of young people over the years who were in very difficult situations like you were in as a child, and they kind of figured out this isn't the way it's supposed to be. And they went down different roads, but on the same kind of search you were on to try to make their life different. Some connected with teachers, some with people in the church, some found parenting figures outside of the family, and some, like you, found their road through the help of a therapist, somebody who could help them rethink their life and go down a different road from their own parent. Go ahead.
I think the important thing also is to make it okay. It's okay to go talk to somebody about your problem and find a couple of solutions, and you can decide which one you want to take. My children have done that with their marriages and saved marriages. I mean, it's so important for the children to find out, well, gee, Mom did it and worked for her, so I think I'll do it too.
Right, and I think it's very important that we speak out the way you are today on the radio and be comfortable. It's almost like consulting with a coach for some of the, you know, somebody who can help solve some, you know, help some of life's difficulties. I wanted to mention some research that I think is very, you know, fits well with the story you've told us, too. There's been quite a bit of research on children who, not like your family in the Great Depression, growing up with a lot of deprivation, but children who've grown up in families where there's a lot of maltreatment, where a parent was abusing the children, so there was violence within the family. And when these families have been followed over time, it's often been the case that children coming out of these families who become successful parents, and many of them do, have, like yourself, found their way to therapy and gotten help to talk through and work out the issues that came out of their family and help to become very effective parents themselves.
The thing, and would you discuss this? Why are people so afraid, or so? That's not the correct word terminology, but there's such a sense of, oh my God, I can't mention that. That's terrible. Sure it is. But what's so bad about discussing it and mentioning it and looking for a solution?
I know. I think that big part of the problem is the stigma associated with seeking help. I don't know why that's come about in our country, but I think that we're much more likely to talk about going to a doctor to get help for a medical problem of some sort. Nobody seems to have any problem talking about that. But many of the people I know, even professionals in the mental health field, seem to have a problem talking about seeking help for a mental health issue or a personal problem like, you know, having trouble with parenting or alcohol or other difficulties. These are incredibly common among people. And yet, I think I agree with you that many people are, you know, afraid to talk about needing help. It's as if they're going to be stigmatized in their life. And I think until people, you know, speak out more and more and people begin to realize these problems are just like you know, going to the dentist or doctor for any kind of health problem, we're not going to see a change in that. So I really appreciate you calling and talking so openly about that.
Could I just mention Giselle? That was my Bible.
Giselle?
Bringing up my children, looking up the age group, you know, from 5 to 10 and then from 10 to 15, and looking up when I remember the day my daughter came home and she says, you know, Mom, she's 14. I don't have a friend. And I thought to myself, you had friends before you went to school. It's 3 o'clock. Why don't you have friends now? And I'm thinking, what happened in those hours? So I got out the book, and sure enough, there it was. Giselle said that at 14, a 14-year-old thinks she doesn't have any friends. So I just said, I just let it go. No big problem. She'll get over it when she's 15. You know, and I think turning to a book for answers, you know, that was a small answer, I agree. That was a small problem. But sometimes there's other solutions that are bigger problems, and there are other solutions to it. I think looking for and discussing and talking and coming up with something, it's satisfying. It lets you sleep at night. So thank you, too, for your program.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And let me just add one more comment. This is another example of how this caller used books to learn about the world. And in this case, she's talking about the whole series of books about child development that were published and have been republished over the years. But there's an awful lot of good information out there about children that parents can consult. I also wanted to mention that I think this caller would really enjoy a book by Glenn Elder, who is a scientist, but who has written a wonderful book from his studies of children who grew up during the Great Depression. So the title of the book is Children of the Great Depression. It was published a number of years ago, probably close to 30 years ago now, but a new edition was put out on the 25th anniversary of its publication. And it is a wonderful book about how children fared during the Great Depression. And he was able to do this book because it so happened that there were two longitudinal studies of children that were ongoing when the Great Depression happened. And they continued to follow the children all the way through those years. And he has studied the children who suffered as their parents went through enormous hardship. And he also emphasizes in this book the children who did well and what made a difference. So I think our caller and others out there would probably find it a very interesting book to read.
Well, we have some other callers here we'll get right to. And just I should introduce again the guest for this hour, Ann Mastin. She is Distinguished McKnight University Professor at the Institute of Child Development at University of Minnesota. She's a licensed psychologist and works in the area of child development. And we've been talking here about the concept of family resiliency. And again, a kind of question that people in child development have been interested in and doing research on now for several decades. The basic question being, how is it that in some cases, children who grow up in families with a lot of problems and disadvantages, certainly some of those kids have a tough time, but you can also find those who have done just fine. And the question is why? What is it that makes the difference? We have some other folks here to talk with, and we'll go next to a caller in, I believe, DeWitt County, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. The resilience of children we should rejoice in that as a testimony to the human spirit, the strength of the human spirit, that a child in a disadvantaged home could turn out well. I wonder, could you speak to the converse problem of someone in a privileged background, like Paris Hilton comes to mind, or Scott Peterson, those people who had all the advantages, and yet they turn out rotten. What could you say about that?
Well, of course, there's a lot of interest in all the ways that children turn out in terms of trying to understand what makes a difference in children's lives. And there are people out there, colleagues of mine, who are just now starting to do a lot more research on advantaged children and their lives, and what kind of problems do they have? What kinds of risk factors are there for their children? We sometimes assume that, you know, having a lot of money or a fancy house really means that you're an advantaged child. But of course, if you look behind closed doors, often you learn that on this, what looks like advantage on the surface is actually a child who may have just as much deprivation as a child who's living in poverty. Because, of course, for children, some of the most important kinds of advantages have to do with the quality of the parenting that they're receiving, the involvement of their parents, their connections with other people. So that's one part of the story, that sometimes the children who appear to be privileged are not truly rich in the relationships that matter. The other thing is that some children simply come into the world more vulnerable for whatever reason. They have more difficulty and they may need a very special kind of attention, and perhaps they don't always get it. But it's, I don't feel like we know as much as we should about advantaged families and their children. And of course, these families often don't volunteer to be part of research studies. They want to stay behind the tall walls, the screen doors, and so forth. And so I think it's hard to know exactly what's going on. The colleague of mine who's doing some very interesting research in this area right now is Sunya Luther, and she's a professor at Columbia University who also studies resilience. And she's studying some of the very wealthy suburban communities of New York City, and she's finding very high risk levels for, particularly in young adolescents, for substance abuse, for depression, and other problems. That things are not as all okay. The kinds of problems that children have may differ, and sometimes there aren't parents around monitoring children in wealthy homes, just like we heard from the caller who grew up in the Great Depression. Sometimes a parent isn't home because they have to work and they don't have the resources to keep adults around. Other times you have two professional parents who are consumed with their jobs that aren't around. So those would be my comments on that. I do think that happens, and that we need to understand more about it. I don't think when you look closely it's as mysterious as it first seems. I think that trying to think about what does it really mean to be an advantaged child, I would certainly put close family relationships at the top of my list for advantage, and some wealthy children don't have that advantage.
Yeah, well, I hope that gets it, at least in part, the question of the caller. We have a couple of others, and we're moving into our last 15 minutes. Excuse me. Again, our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Ann Mastin. She's a professor in the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. And particularly, we've been talking about the question of family resiliency, something that she's done a lot of research on. We'll go next to a caller in Chicago, and this should be line number two. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Mm-hmm. You said you couldn't imagine experience worse than the Holocaust, and I was thinking probably the experience of child soldiers is worse. And I know the UN has tried to bring attention to that because it's a problem that affects most of the continents, maybe not North America, but certainly South America. And I was wondering, I know that they have tried to do some rehabilitation of child soldiers, especially in Mozambique and Angola, and I wonder if you are familiar with any of those studies. Are those children ever able to survive or their past experience and establish family relationships as adults?
You know, I'm not familiar on all of the research as those children have grown up, but I certainly have colleagues who are following the young child soldiers. And as you say, I don't even know if it's important to compare. The horror of the experiences these children have gone through is on a, certainly on the scale of of catastrophe of these other child survivors of war. And I know that some of the child soldiers in Mozambique, it's been very difficult first to bring them back and connect them to families and villages of origin. And it's been very difficult in part because a lot of these children were forced to commit atrocities against members of their own family and village. And the one theme that has stood out in my mind as I've heard the reports of people who have tried to help with this situation, either on the behalf of the UN or have worked with these children directly, is that forgiveness is a very important theme. And in a village, that where a child is brought back, that there has to be some sort of process or rituals of forgiveness. But it is probably most difficult for a child to forgive himself who's been through this kind of situation. I hope that we will learn more about this over time. Of course, I'd like to see a world where we have fewer and fewer and eventually no child soldiers, particularly these children that are kidnapped into service in these guerrilla warfares still going on all over the world. But the rehabilitation process has been a difficult one, I understand. But I would certainly feel that the core ingredients of recovery would be very similar to the recovery from a lot of other awful experiences with children, which is, being in a situation where you have very positive adults around you and a chance to do something positive. A lot of kids after war, whether they've been child soldiers or simply caught up as bystanders in warfare, one of the problems teenagers have is they feel like their world has been destroyed and there's no future and hope for them. And I think a lot of kids, including some of these child soldiers, really have benefited from opportunities to do something, to be appreciated by their communities, to be part of rebuilding efforts, to be part of helping younger children. I think that the belief that life has meaning and that an individual child has a future can be rebuilt. But after these terrible experiences, it may take a while. But kids having the opportunities not only to be part of a family and community, but to contribute, to do something, to help rebuild.
Well, that's why
has been
I did
good.
Make the comparison, because I think there's a difference between the Holocaust and being caught up in a war experience and being a child soldier, in that war by nature destroys the social structure and mm-hmm. life as people know it. But the people who use child soldiers intentionally often make them do things that make them totally a pariah in breaking the social bonds, such as quite often they're forced to assassinate a family relative,
right.
And that a family member. And that's why I'm wondering if it's even harder to rehabilitate these children, because even should the social structure reassemble itself after war, these children, by what they've had to go through, are outside, are pariahs. And that's why I was wondering if their rehabilitation was particularly difficult.
And as I said, I haven't done direct research on this myself, but it is my understanding that it can be very difficult, but that there are successful efforts in different places of the world where people are working with these young people and trying to rebuild, connections with communities, sometimes in community of origin, which can be very difficult for the reasons you mentioned, and sometimes in new communities.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Urbana, line number 3 for someone else. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. Actually, just a two-part question. It's my understanding since there's been an increase in terms of depression, and I think particularly mild depression, from this group from 1964, born after that, and it seems that's been increasing. So if you look at, you know, your group versus, you know, this group, the general group, are there some similar factors, or what would you account for this?
So it sounds like your question is depression increasing?
But among young
people.
Right.
There is, of course, sometimes it's hard to get really great data on this because people always wonder, well, are we doing a better job measuring this now? Are children more revealing about what's going on now? But my take from the people who do research on depression in young people is that there does appear to be an increase in depression that is not totally understood at this point. And I think many people feel that there may be a high stress level that is in part accounting for this, that particularly in early adolescence in our time, we have the largest what people call maturity gap probably ever in human history, meaning that children, young people in a lot of the industrialized, advantaged countries economically are maturing earlier and earlier, and many people are aware of this, particularly obviously in girls. Puberty is starting earlier and earlier, and yet it's taking longer and longer in the United States and similar economies for young people to get going in life. So we've now even had to invent a whole new phase of life we call emerging adulthood or something like that, because people aren't ready to kind of be, you know, move out onto their own till they're in their mid to late 20s. So we have this huge long period where kids are adolescents, and you have a lot of changes occurring in those, particularly in that early adolescent window. And at the same time, we, particularly in the United States, we have a lot of adults who are incredibly busy and not, you know, not providing a lot of what people in my profession like to call scaffolding, sort of a support structure to help kids negotiate these periods of great change. And you have all of the changes of the media. I mean, kids are learning about and experiencing things, all kinds of information, through very different kinds of media than I might have experienced as a teenager many years ago. So you have a very complex world. They're being, you know, kids are being inundated with information. You have this sort of constant downward trend of kids becoming teenagers, in effect, and what they do and think about earlier and earlier. We have fewer adults out there providing support to kids during this period of transition. Parents who have to work many hours often to succeed in life. And so people are wondering, do we just have, you know, a cohort of young people who are simply negotiating a lot of change with less support and experiencing it in the form of stress, which is contributing to depression? That's a long answer to your question, but I think a lot of my colleagues who are interested in depression in young people are wondering about that, whether we just have what we're seeing as a function of a burden, a strain on young people, that they're dealing with more and more change, a world that's going very fast, growing up too soon in many ways, without as much support as even they used to have.
We're unfortunately just about at the time when we're going to have to stop, and I wish we could continue. There are a lot of other things we could talk about. You talked about the fact that for children to succeed, they really need to have a stable, reliable adult in their life. It would be nice if that was a parent, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. And unfortunately, I give you about a minute to answer the question. I'm just curious about who it is, if it's not parents, who it turns out to be for some kids.
Well, that's a great question, and I've seen it be many different kinds of people. And there are many autobiographical accounts by famous people who talk about the importance of these adults. Sometimes it's a relative. Grandmothers and fathers have played a very important role in resilience. Sometimes it's neighbors in stable areas who just strike up a friendship with a child, or they have a common interest. Sometimes it's a teacher. And as children get older, more often it's a mentoring type of figure. And often somebody they meet through their daily life at school, at church. Other times it's a mentor who's part of a program like Big Brothers or Big Sisters or some other kind of mentoring program, which is deliberately established to help young people. So I think it's important that young people have opportunities where they can come into contact with competent and pro-social adults that they have a chance to form mentoring relationships with. But it can come in many different forms, but that connection appears to be a very important protective factor for child development.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank
you. Ann Mastin, she is a professor in the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota.